the legacies of America's First Ladies and how they impact our lives today. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, September 24th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, they hosted, they traveled, they influenced. We talk with First Lady scholar and author Diana Carlin. Then, when you go to work every day in a school or office, you might end up in conflict with colleagues now and again. Today's Teacher Talk explores ways to make conflict a more positive experience. Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur are with us. Plus, Decision 2024, a new frontline film, looks at Harris, Trump, and the ways in which their ideas of leadership are formed. Michael Kirk joins us later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Early voting in South Dakota has begun. America will choose a new president. In doing so, we'll decide which presidential partner will represent our interests on the world stage. Now, the most enduring White House legacies are not always those of the men who serve the nation as president. Presidential spouses, first ladies, if you will, serve as hostess and domestic diplomat, fashion icon, and White House steward. It's their initiatives, however, that have changed our lives, especially the lives of women and girls in America. Diana B. Carlin is Professor Emerita of Communications at St. Louis University and a retired professor of communication studies at the University of Kansas. She's co-author of the book Remember the Ladies, The Legacies of America's History-Making Women. All right, let's talk about this book because this is a new look at First Ladies. In as much as it is not a series of biographies of famous women, it is looking at the office and the way these women have changed it over time. So can we start with the idea that, you know, this is not an elected office, there's no constitutional, you know, precedent for what the behavior or the office is supposed to be. Are women just making this up as they go? Take us back in time, please.
Well, they all approach it their own way. Martha Washington was the one who definitely had to make it up as she was going along. And Abigail Adams and Dolly Madison did a little bit of the same. But much of what they put in place is still being done. For instance, the hostess role is still a very important part. And there's a lot of what we call soft diplomacy going along with that. But they all are affected by their backgrounds, by their own interests. Their marriage has a lot to do with what they're able to do. The first ladies who've had really solid relationships with husbands who wanted to support them often give them a lot of free rein, where others, for instance, Calvin Coolidge, thought it was great for Grace to do very traditional hostess things, which he didn't want her to do anything new. So there are a lot of different factors that affect it. But I think the point you made at the beginning, that this isn't an elective office, it isn't a constitutionally charged office. It's one that has grown out of the fact that our president is both the head of government and the head of state. So in a lot of other countries, you have a monarch who's the head of state, or you have, you know, like a president who's head of state, prime minister who's head of government. So those roles of, you know, pardoning turkeys and hosting delegations and state dinners goes to the head of state, but our president has to do both. And the Washingtons realized he needed help. So that was where Martha came in. But because it isn't a requirement, many first ladies have decided to do very little, and they have that choice. So there really is a lot of latitude in how they approach it.
Were there significant gaps in scholarship that you found where the research was waiting to be discovered, but there hadn't been a book like yours previously?
Yeah, the scholarship has been, as you said earlier, a lot of biographical collections. That was where it started. And that was important because these women were virtually unknown, especially many of the 19th century women. And then there have been a lot of individual biographies. There have been books that have looked at, for instance, the modern First Lady And especially there's a new one by Katie Rogers in the New York Times, just looking from Hillary Clinton on. Others that have looked at, for instance, there's one on Southern First Ladies and the influence of the South on the position. And because so many of our first First Ladies, except for Abigail Adams, were Southerners, that did have a large influence, especially on entertaining and this kind of soft diplomacy. So those were, you know, some of the things that I think really were happening. And what we wanted was a book that looked at the position itself and all of the factors that have affected that position, the one I just mentioned. And also, the role of women in society has changed. So as that role has changed, women have taken on new responsibilities as First Lady. So, for instance, when we had the 19th Amendment in 1920 and women were voting, you began to see them getting a little more active in campaigns, to the point where now, you know, the spouse has a full schedule, independent schedule. But that didn't really come into play until 1964 with Lady Bird. So a lot of evolution, and that's what we wanted to look at, was the historical factors and the themes that these women have addressed over time. And when you do a bunch of individual biographies, you can't and many of them were edited with many authors, a different author for every biography. You can't pull those threads together. Yeah. So, for example, Martha Washington was very dedicated to veterans and to widows. And we have, you know, Jill Biden and Michelle Obama, you know, joining forces. Mm-hmm. They're still looking at military families. So that's been a thread that's connected the first First Lady with the current First Lady, and we've had First Ladies all along the way who have supported veterans. So those are the kinds of things that we wanted to pull through the book that no one else had done. And I think that's a piece of the scholarship that was missing, was really how you link all of this context together with the women who've held the position.
The incoming First Lady, does she have a sense of that history? Does Dr. Jill Biden know that Martha Washington cared about these things? Is there a way for her to learn that? Or is that all on her to sort of, you know, follow her interest in learning about the role?
Well, it's a little bit of both. For several years now, there has been a book prepared for the First Lady. I don't know if they've done it every election cycle, but it's sort of a report to the incoming First Lady that has some of this history in it. It tends to be a little more, you know, biographical, but it looks at the role of the press. And so that book's hard to get a hold of. One of my co-authors, Nancy Keegan Smith, has a copy of it. And so we did, you know, look at that. So there is an attempt to really bring that history to them. And many of them have done a lot of that research on their own. But at the same time, they want to do the things that really stir their souls, mm-hmm. and that they're passionate about. So they have the sense of history because they do get some briefings, but they also pave their own way.
How important is stewardship of the White House in the role of First Lady?
The stewardship of the White House is extremely important. In fact, our book dedicates an entire chapter to that, where we look at the role of the First Ladies with the White House. The Adams were the first to live there, and they were only there for a few months because John didn't move in until December of 1800, and then he went out of office in March, and it was really not even complete. And then after the War of 1812, it had to be rebuilt, and the Monroes, Elizabeth Monroe, had a lot to do with that. But the real stewardship came with Jackie Kennedy. She had gone through the White House as a child, and there wasn't even a brochure, and she thought it was kind of tattered, and it was, because Congress never appropriated enough money, and that's why it was falling apart by the time the Trumans got there. And they had to move out, and they had to basically take it down to the walls. And there's a picture in our book that shows that. So Jackie Kennedy realized there'd never be enough government money, so she established the White House Historical Association, which is over 60 years old now. And so much of what's done to preserve the White House is done through private funding, through the White House Historical Association. And other First Ladies have taken that seriously. Lady Bird continued with some of her work, and Pat Nixon completed a lot of what Jackie Kennedy wanted to do, bringing in original artifacts, not necessarily original to the White House itself, but to the time periods that they were wanting to reflect in each of the rooms. You will still see, you know, renovations being done. Laura Bush renovated the Lincoln bedroom, for example, and Melania Trump did several things inside, but also with the gardens. So they all take that role very seriously.
How much private political influence do these women have, do these spouses have?
Much. especially the more recent first ladies. As I said, they actually have from the beginning. Yeah. You know, Martha burned all of the letters between the two of them, but of course she was with him all of the time. But in some of her letters to family, she had some opinions about our relations with England, and I'm sure she expressed those to George, but she stayed out of the political fray. But we had some very powerful early first ladies, such as Abigail Adams, who was very influential in appointments and in pushing him to sign the Alien and Sedition Act, which ended up being his downfall. Sarah Polk, who no one knows anything about, was one of the most powerful first ladies we had. She wrote his speeches. She was a gatekeeper. Of course, we had Edith Wilson, who was doing quite a bit as almost an acting president during his stroke rehabilitation. And then Nancy Reagan, you know, Lady Bird, was very influential. I believe Dr. Biden, you know, she gave us an interview for the book, and she was just saying that she wasn't an advisor, but she was a spouse, and they talked about their work, her work and his, and in that way, she could bring ideas to him that she was picking up from students and from people she knew. And like I said, Nancy Reagan certainly had a lot of influence, including helping to get the Cold War ended. So many of these women have had a tremendous amount of influence on their husbands through the private conversations.
Yeah. And does that cause a pain point for advisors who aren't in the bedroom at night, essentially?
Well, it can. And there have certainly been tensions between the East Wing and the West Wing more than once. And, you know, most first ladies who are savvy realize that anything they want to do, they have to have the support of the West Wing to do it. One of my other co-authors, Anita McBride, was Laura Bush's chief of staff. And Mrs. Bush brought her on during the second term, and Anita had been at the State Department, and Mrs. Bush wanted to go to Afghanistan because she was very concerned about Afghan women and girls. And when she talked to Anita about the position, she told her what she wanted to do. And Anita said the first question she asked her was, is the West Wing supportive? And she said yes. And Anita always makes that point that a successful first lady, you know, works with the West Wing, that they're all on the same page. And as I said, when they haven't been, there can be some tensions.
You've been talking about these women, but certainly in the future of America, there should be a first gentleman at some point. So that brings the opportunity to talk about the first ladies who have set precedent and the ways that that changes the role and the ways that matters to the country when somebody new, whether it's Jill Biden with her job outside of the White House, or it's Michelle Obama as the first Black first lady. What's the role of and the impact of precedent-setting first ladies or first spouses?
Well, precedence is important, but the thing we talk about in the book is that these women have been mirrors of society at the time, so following precedents have followed in the footsteps of their predecessors, but they've also been change agents. And when we have a first gentleman, and, you know, at some point we're going to have one, we came close, you know, in 2016, we have a possibility this time, it may or may not happen. And if it doesn't, it's certainly going to happen at some point, because there are more and more women governors, more women, 25 in the Senate, so more and more women are in the pipeline. And I think the precedents will impact a first gentleman. And if we look at the way Doug Emhoff has been the second gentleman, it's been very traditional. when asked what his most important responsibility is, he said to support his wife. And that's really what most first ladies will tell you, that everything they do is to support their husband, his administration, his policies in the best way they can. And I believe that is really the direction a first gentleman will go. I fully expect a first gentleman to continue to work, and that's where I think Dr. Biden opened that door in some ways for a first gentleman. So we can envision now the president's spouse being working outside the White House. Mm-hmm. And that had certainly not been done before. So she did set that new precedent of being able to work outside. And issues, you know, they're going to have issues, too, that they care about. So I don't think we're going to see a dramatic change in the approach to being a supportive spouse to the president.
Are there first ladies who have been more effective than perhaps their husbands at creating a legacy that we recognize today?
Oh, I think definitely there have been some. You know, if you look at Betty Ford, for example, she was first lady for less than 3 years, and what she accomplished was nothing short of amazing, especially given her health issues. What she did with bringing breast cancer and the need for early detection into the open. At the time in 1974, when she was diagnosed, we wouldn't have been able to say the word breast or cancer in this interview. You did not say the word breast in the news, and no one used the word cancer when they would be reporting someone's illness. So she said it was time to bring it out into the open because she was going about her business, and all of a sudden she's in the hospital with a mastectomy, and she knows there are other women who have undetected. And so she saved lives, and she continued to do that after First Lady. Then her addiction to prescription drugs and alcohol, she came out in the open, and the Hazelden Betty Ford Center has helped thousands of people. I mean, that's just an enduring legacy. If you look at Barbara Bush and her Literacy Foundation, she started doing that when she was second lady and then really pushed it as first lady and started her foundation. They've given over $100 million in literacy programming support, and there will probably be more, you know, in the future. So, you know, those are just a couple examples. What Michelle Obama is doing with women worldwide and girls' issues is an incredible legacy. So we have Jackie Kennedy, White House Historical Association, 63 years. So these first ladies are able to have these lasting legacies, largely because the issues they take on are not overtly political. They aren't as policy oriented, and we saw when a first lady tries to get into policy, as Hillary Clinton did with healthcare, huge pushback, and that's just really not a direction that they can or should go. So the kinds of issues they take on are bigger societal issues that go beyond partisan politics, and I believe that's why they're able to have this lasting impact that is very well known. Rosalynn Carter, another example with what she did with mental health and caregivers. Mm-hmm. So these women in some ways outshine their husbands post-presidency. Eleanor Roosevelt with the UN and the Declaration of Human Rights. So it's really pretty amazing when you stop and look at it.
Yeah, it's astonishing
what they have done.
It's astonishing when you string them together. Yeah,
and there are more. You know, I could keep going. And that's another point we make in the book. Is when you put all those together in a single chapter, it's pretty profound, the impact that they've had.
That is quite a string of pearls.
Yes, I like that.
All right, what if they debated? Hypothetically, if there was a first lady debate, what would you advise?
Oh, that's an interesting one. Well, they kind of debate with recipes. We've had cookie bake-offs a couple times. Yeah, interesting that you should say that because, as you mentioned, one of my other areas of research is political debates, presidential debates. And there was a debate between Eleanor Roosevelt, who was no longer a first lady at the time, and Margaret Chase Smith representing Eisenhower and Stevenson on Face the Nation. Huh. And you can find it online. And so we did have a former first lady debating. I think no one has asked this. This is an interesting question. I think if they debated, I would want the questions to really center on the role and, you know, what they think they needed to do to support their husbands and what they think as a first lady they can do in a nonpartisan way. Because that's one thing the first ladies all say is, you know, they've been called like the comforter in chief after tragedies like 9/11. And Lou Henry Hoover was going on the radio to try to help women get through the Depression. And that's nonpartisan. Yeah. So I'd like to hear them talk about the importance of the nonpartisanship of the First Lady and then talk about what their legacy, you know, what they want it to be. Yeah. So those would be a couple of the things, how they believe the First Lady should support her husband and what they think the limits of the position are. Yeah. Those would be some of the questions I'd want them to answer.
Yeah. Any other thoughts that you want to leave us with today?
I think, you know, the part of the reason we wrote the book, I taught a course for over 30 years, and students knew nothing about first ladies, and they kept saying, why didn't we learn this in history?
Yeah.
As we have been going around the country talking about the book, people say, why didn't I learn this? And that's why we wrote the book. This started out as a textbook, and our editor said, why didn't I learn this? Would you be willing to do a different version for the public? Yeah. Because this is an incredible important part of our history. And I don't think you can understand the presidency completely without understanding the role of the spouse. And if we want this inclusive history, then I think you have to include these women in it.
Diana Carlin is co-author of the book, Remember the Ladies, The Legacies of America's History-Making Women. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Conflict is a natural part of dealing with other people. Today's Teacher Talk features part 4 of Gina Benz's Dear New Teacher series. We're going to focus on how to best deal with conflict and colleagues. Gina Benz is a recipient of the Milken Educator Award. She is in her 25th year of teaching, and she helps the next generation of educators find their way through the Teacher Pathway Program. Dr. Jackie Wilbur is on the faculty of the University of South Dakota. She's director of the Center for Student and Professional Services in the School of Education. Here's our conversation.
I actually have a little bit of some butterflies in my stomach. My throat's a little tight right now because talking about conflict is hard.
Yeah, yeah. Talking about conflict with colleagues.
Really
is
hard.
Hard. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Jackie, is this something that when you first started teaching made you nervous too?
I have learned about myself that I am a little unique. I like conflict.
Interesting.
Yeah, I do. I'm like might be too strong of a word, but I maybe embrace it would be a better term to use. But when the stakes are higher, like I worry about having conflict with Gina one day, you know, I think about that because our relationship is so important to me. And so the stakes are so high, but like healthy work conflict or healthy colleague conflict is something that I value because I value diversity of ideas. And I don't know, I just see a lot of positives in conflict, but when the stakes are high, no, I don't like that at all.
I love that as a foundation for our conversation because, you know, the first thing you say is stay away from unnecessary conflict.
Yeah, I think sometimes I am even guilty of this where the drama feels juicy and exciting and or you're frustrated and you want to just see who, all the other people who are frustrated like you are. And like we said in a previous episode of Dear New Teacher, instead of making a forest fire, let's just extinguish that campfire instead. Yeah. So
I feel like it's important to say that if you find that drama exciting, that might be a familiar energy to you.
Ooh.
So we've talked about this before that, you know, maybe you grew up in a family or in a situation where that was very normal. And so it feels oddly comforting or familiar in the sense that, so don't beat yourself up too much if you're the kind of unnecessary conflict person. It might just be something that you have a lot of experience with and you might have to step a few steps back mm-hmm. and reflect, what is it about that that's exciting and fun for you?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, I think that I try to avoid as much as I can because I have to pick my battles type of person. Yeah. We only have so much energy to give. And that has worked for me to decide how many battles I can fight and leave the rest to other people.
Yeah. So venting is part of your, under this heading is, you know, hey, when your colleagues are just gathering to complain or to vent, what's wrong with venting, Jackie?
I was actually watching Simon Sinek talk about this in The Workplace, and he was saying it's venting can very quickly segue into gossiping, and that is where things can become challenging, particularly in the school environment or in the teacher's lounge, if you will. It's one thing to hear someone say, like, wow, I'm feeling frustrated, I'm having a hard time with X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. And then it's another thing to have that become, like, talking badly about people, talking badly about situations in a way that just is draining, and to use the words Gina just did. And so we do only have a limited amount of energy and a limited amount of time. And so to get kind of sucked in on someone's negative way of going can be very draining. So I think it's okay to have a small amount of vent or to say, like, whew, I'm really feeling this way, or I just need to kind of get this off my chest, or to let someone else do that with you, but to not let it segue into that, like, more negative, just energetic vortex of, like, now we're just doing this, like, kind of mean thing that doesn't really resolve any issues or make anyone feel better. In fact, kind of perpetuates that same yeah. feeling.
I always recall, and I can't remember where I read it, but that if you're venting, that is only good for a short period of time before mm-hmm. you blow. So when you're venting like a volcano, what you're really doing is trying to prevent a bigger explosion. So your intentions might be good, but you're not really preventing. You're going to have to vent again tomorrow mm-hmm. and the next day and the next day unless you get down to what's really going on.
Yeah.
And that's the actual conflict. So now that we've avoided unnecessary conflict because we're perfect and self-actualized and we never go toward anything unnecessary, the next is just spend a few minutes thinking about that person's good qualities. Tell me about that, Gina.
This one is tremendously helpful to me personally. When I feel frustrated with a colleague or anybody in my life, I remind myself of maybe three good things about that person. And mm-hmm. it's just a reminder that we're all doing our best. Everybody's doing the best they can. We just have different passions, different philosophies, different ways of doing things.
Yeah. Jackie, mm-hmm. what would you add to that? Just spending time thinking about another person's good qualities.
I think that's such a great way to cope with situations like this. And I think we don't love to say this as teachers, but I was listening to a TED Talk the other day, and that teacher who was speaking reminded us that we have sometimes those feelings with our students, like they just happen to do this thing that kind of will grate on us. And you need to like all of your students, or at least make them feel as though you like all of them. And so it's a really good skill to be able to think about what someone's good qualities are. And I have found when I do that, I genuinely do remember that I like them. You know, I may not like this thing that's happening. I may not like this conflict that we're going through, but I see them as a person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Most people have good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. A lot of times it's just a difference in what you emphasize in your life, what your philosophies are, not necessarily wrong, just different.
I want to know what kinds of conflict mm-hmm. teachers tend. Yeah. Are there themes that you see in a school that this is the kind of conflict that often, you know, you should keep your eyes open for?
I think about different philosophies for assessment could be a big one. How often you assess, how you assess, what those assessments look like. Are you a person who believes in projects and essays, or a person who believes in multiple choice tests and quizzes? Do you think assessments should happen every week, every other week, every few weeks?
Okay, so you just don't agree on how something maybe should be done.
Yeah, and I would say also you might disagree on how students are held accountable to things.
Sure.
And so there's people with very good intentions who want to make sure they lead their students toward becoming more responsible human beings.
Yeah.
There's also people with really good intentions who want to acknowledge the tremendous struggles any certain student might have and offer a little bit more patience and grace.
Yeah. Jackie, what would you add to that? Any themes that you see come up with regularity?
Mm-hmm. And there are so many times when, as a school building, you kind of have to get on the same page. You know, there might be like a some kind of a policy or school system-wide thing that's happening where the teachers are consulted and we kind of have to say, we're all going to do it this way. And that, I always think, is very difficult because it's really difficult at any point in any organization to get everyone to say, yep, I think we all think that's a good idea. Do I think that's healthy? Yes. And normal? Absolutely. But then it's sort of teaching is not parenting, but I think parenting has this, like, we need to be a united front on certain issues type of aspect to it, and that is also true of the teaching profession. Yeah. So I think similarly, where parents may not always agree on, you know, snack time, that kind of thing comes up with teaching as well.
Yeah. Okay. Around here, I think I would, you know, we're just all so tired.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure teachers are too. Anybody listening to this who has a job, and maybe even if you don't have a job, however you define job, we're all tired. Everybody is just trying to do so much. So that's one of our common conflicts, is just somebody just doesn't have the capacity, you know, to do the next thing, and their brain is tired. And and that can be hard because the things need to be done.
Yeah, I think it's really important at those moments to recognize that in yourself and then verbalize it to other people.
Yeah.
I want to say, too, another common conflict, especially nowadays, and probably more so at the high school level, is phones and student phone use. And again, everyone's very well-meaning. Some, you know, want to make sure the phones are locked away so that there's no distractions and kids can have this oasis away from social media and phones.
Sure.
But others are of the mind that phones will always be in their lives, and we need to teach teenagers how to responsibly and respectfully use phones in any situation.
Yeah.
And I could argue both sides.
So that brings us to be curious, not furious. Listen well before you plan your defense, Gina.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good life rule.
Mm-hmm.
I had it in another episode, a recent episode. Be curious, not furious.
I just like to say that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know.
It's a good bumper sticker. Yeah.
There you go. So this is the one I'm working on the most, and where I disappoint myself the most, where somebody says something, and rather than asking more questions, I right away respond with my opinion or my philosophy. And I always wish I would have responded first with a level of understanding and then seeking more understanding. And I wish that for people's interactions with me as well, that they would ask me more questions if they're disagreeing with where I'm at.
Yeah, we all, and that's, you know, hey, welcome to America in
2024. Oh, my.
And I want to bring social media back into this, or the use of your phones, because, and what I said about everybody being tired, it's not just that we're tired at work. We're tired. We get the impression that we have spent the day listening to other people. If you have been watching social media, but really you haven't been listening to other people, you know, these things have been coming into your head. So you do have to kind of clear a space to be curious about where someone else is coming from. Jackie, what would you add to this? You know, how do you listen well?
I used to teach speech and when I taught high school, and I did, my first unit was always on listening. And so a key portion of communication is being a good listener, and you really need a good audience, an audience training before you have high school students go up in front of the room and stand in front of their peers. So I always started with that. And one of the things that always stood out to the high school students was that oftentimes when we're listening to someone, we are imagining what the other person is actually meaning or thinking or what their intentions are. And we don't have any of that evidence, but we're filling in based on our past experiences, maybe what their facial expressions are. But we're kind of making up in our own mind a little bit of filling in some gaps that that can happen. And so that is one of the things that happens when we listen is like, I'm hearing you speak, but then I'm getting noisy in my own mind with like, well, she probably really meant that. And what did that facial expression mean? And I'm adding this extra noise to the words that are coming out of the person that I'm listening to mouth. And so that's one of the things that I was surprised when I would teach that listening unit was that students really gravitated towards that idea of noticing their own internal dialogue being loud when they were listening to someone else. Mm-hmm. So just being aware of that own your own internal noise that's happening when you're paying attention to someone else can be really helpful because you can kind of quiet that down just by noticing it and then pay attention to what someone's actually saying. Yeah. We also have a tendency to think about what we're going to say next when we're listening to someone else. So I'm crafting my response while you're talking. Rather than listening to what you're actually saying.
Why do we do that?
I think a variety of reasons. Some people are anxious about what they're going to say. Some people anticipate quickly and think, oh, I know where this is going. Let me just respond here. So I think there's a number of reasons that is also a natural speech pattern is that we craft what we're going to say in our head first, but we don't allow for a lot of pausing between exchanges in our current culture. So it's you kind of have to do that to speak as quickly as we do.
Teacher Talk is also a podcast. Find it on your preferred podcast platform. And you can find all the companion blogs, including links to research on our website, sdpb.org/teachertalk. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Tonight, PBS Frontline's election special series returns. The Choice docuseries explores the lives and characters of the candidates seeking the presidency. Filmmaker Michael Kirk is director, producer, and writer on The Choice 2024, Harris versus Trump. Let's begin with how the candidates' upbringings shaped them into the people they are today. We start with Donald Trump.
Fred Trump, Sr., had an empire that was as many as several thousand departments. When you drive into New York through Brooklyn or Queens, you see all these sort of 20-story buildings, and I mean a lot of them. Well, Fred Trump built all of those, and Donald inherited those. The net worth in the early 70s of his father was $200 million, which would be a few billion dollars probably now. He grew up in a family where the father was driven, and Donald learned lessons early about working hard and following his father's rule, which is there are winners and losers in society. You are either a winner or you're a loser. And if you think about the implications of that on Donald Trump, and we trace them all the way through the film, you think about the implications of the voice of his father, whose picture he kept on his desk or behind his desk in the Oval Office, his father's words ringing in his ears, you're either a winner or a loser. And on that election night where it was becoming clear that he was going to lose to Joe Biden in 2020, it was almost impossible for Donald Trump. In fact, it would have been impossible and was impossible for Donald Trump to do anything but claim that it was a fraud and that the election had been stolen.
Vice President Harris has a very strong mother, but in very different ways. Tell us a little bit about her upbringing.
So her mother, Shyamala, is a Brahmin Indian from India. It comes to the United States against her parents' wishes at 19, settles in Berkeley, California, just outside of San Francisco, as a researcher, a cancer researcher at the University of California, Berkeley. She marries a black man from Jamaica. They have young Kamala in the late 60s, early 70s. They raise her in that environment, which was very much Black Panthers, Hare Krishnas, conga drummers, black, white, Asian, a real mix in that world. And they raised Kamala because of the color of her skin and her sister's skin as a black person. The parents were quite radical liberals in the times when, you know, there were lots of civil disobedience, the anti-war movement, the free speech movement. So that it was ingrained in Kamala. She's biracial, but the black part of her is very, very important. And B, that she have a streak of social justice that buried deep inside of her. So the difference could not be more stark between Donald Trump and his stern father saying winners and losers and imbuing Donald with the determination and the mandate to be a powerful winner all of his life. And Kamala Harris's mother, who basically, her parents divorced when she's very young, basically raised by a mother who is determined to plant social justice inside a child who, despite her mother's Indian heritage, decides to raise as a black little kid. It's a fascinating difference and one that reveals itself throughout their lives.
Let's talk a little bit about this first time that the Department of Justice really comes after the Trump family for racial discrimination, and how that experience with the federal government is formative for him to this day.
The federal government comes in and discovers through many witnesses and others, files a case against the Trump company for discrimination against black people and other people of color. The evidence is on a form, an application form that potential renters would fill out after the agent for the Trump company showed them the apartment. He would write a big C on the piece of paper to connote that they were colored, as it says in the material that was used in the lawsuit of the government's case. And that all by itself, this idea that they were doing what they could to not populate their buildings with people of color, becomes the basis for the biggest case ever at the time by the federal government. Donald's father is sort of, okay, well, we'll do what we have to do. And Donald doesn't like that. And Donald's lawyer doesn't like the lawyers for the company who are saying, oh, just settle it, get it out of the way. So he goes into Manhattan and meets a famous and legendary lawyer named Roy Cohn, who's been on the McCarthy hearings back with Joe McCarthy in the early 50s. Notorious, hardcore, New York, feisty lawyer who took on all the seemly cases and the unseemly cases and other events like that. Donald hires him because what Roy and he do is a kind of mind meld. They find they both like to shake their fists at the government. They like to fight back. Many, many, many of the characteristics that we see in Donald Trump to this day come from the playbook that he learned at the hands of Roy Cohn. And at times in his life, he has been known to sit even in the Oval Office and shout out, "Where is my Roy Cohn?" when the forces of the FBI and everyone else seems to be coming at him. And he's trying to remember that the plan to be a winner that his father insisted on and the method that Roy has taught him, which is fight back, hit people three times as hard as they hit you, never accept defeat, lie, whatever you have to do to win in those moments, especially against the government. Well, that probably rings true to almost anyone who's listening to our conversation about the Donald Trump. They know, and it really is the moment where he gets the plan for how to act the rest of his adult life.
Kamala Harris is developing her own playbook as a college student and a sorority member at Howard University. What's the importance of Alpha Kappa Alpha to her today?
She faces a decision. Do you fight from the outside like my mom and dad did and join protests and maybe become an ACLU lawyer or something like that? Or do you try to find your way into the inside of the government and make change happen from inside? So if Donald Trump is shaking his fist at the government and attacking from outside, we're watching the story with Kamala Harris of a young woman who decides to go to work on the inside. But Howard University, where she went to school, an all-black university, is in the heart of Washington, D.C. She's there around and internships in various eight government agencies and realizes that she wants to get inside and play the inside game. And at Howard, the group of young black women, a sorority called Alpha Kappa Alpha, becomes kind of a home for that. That's what they get known for. It's the most powerful black female sorority in America, even now. And it is a place where an awful lot of very powerful and successful black women have either come through as students or been brought into once they've achieved fame. Kamala joins that group and learns to be the Kamala Harris who can fight from inside. She learns how to dress. She learns how to act. She learns how to approach the inside. And using the connections that she learns,
There are several times, and we know somewhat through experience, Donald Trump's playbook when he is handed a defeat or a setback, how he repositions those as victories. Kamala Harris suffers many political bruises throughout her career. How does she handle those missteps or those attacks?
She's the district attorney in San Francisco, brand new on the job, 4 months into the job. A police officer gets shot by a perpetrator and murdered. The police force, all the other politicians in California, very powerful politicians, all expect a death penalty and the DA to file for the death penalty. She has promised in her campaign that she would never do that. So she takes what for her is a principled stand, and the police just hate her for it. They shun her in the hallways. And if you're a district attorney and you don't have the police department kind of on your side because you're working closely with them, that is a very big problem. At the funeral for the police officer, Dianne Feinstein stands up and addresses the crowd and says, this is surely a death penalty case, and essentially slaps Kamala Harris, who's sitting in the crowd, down for this. And the police officers and the people in the church stand up, roaring. Kamala Harris learns a lesson very early in her first decision in an elected office, that you take principled stands that you haven't assessed whether they're popular or not at your own peril. She will always, for the rest of her life, political life, be very careful about what she does, how she handles, how she talks about controversial topics. We learned from this that as President of the United States, Kamala Harris will be careful about the big issues. So it gets hard to pin her down on some of the big issues. Not hard about abortion, not hard about some gun control. So it's a very interesting tightrope she's walking. And she learned to get on that tightrope at that first case, first big case when she's a district attorney in San Francisco.
The role of Pastor Paula White, you highlight to talk about how Donald Trump courts evangelicals. That, I think, has been a bit underreported in the past. What does he say to evangelicals?
Well, he can't really say anything because his history follows him wherever he goes. As we know, allegations of sexual abuse, the words from the Access Hollywood moment. He's well known for having these kind of perspectives. So it's hard for him to talk his way out of those. But he forms an alliance very early with Pastor Paula White, who's down in his neck of the woods, and forms a friendship with her, an alliance with her. She says she prayed about him, and she had other pastors pray about him. And I think it matters a great deal to many evangelical Christians that Pastor Paula White supports Donald Trump despite his sins, and in fact thinks in some ways that he's been anointed by God to come forward at this time in the country's history, and despite his reputation and his actions, that he's the one, and that's very valuable to Donald Trump.
Michael Kirk is the filmmaker behind PBS Frontline's The Choice 2024, Harris versus Trump. The two-hour documentary premieres tonight at 6 Central, 5 Mountain, on pbs.org/frontline. You can also catch it on SDPB-TV at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, or find it on YouTube or pbs.org anytime after its premiere. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.